Property damage 7,200 buildings and 1,491 non-fatal injuries. So this 20-meter diameter thing on February 15th, 2013, that was the most recent near-Earth object. They called it a near-Earth asteroid. And to my knowledge, nobody knew that one was coming. I guess it was you asking some of the questions about this. N2MB, Barry, go ahead. N2 Moonbounce, K2RIW.
Even if they knew it was coming, they couldn't do anything about it, right?
So, by the way, it's very important. Both the 2013 event and the 1908 event, in both cases, they never knew it was coming. Had no forewarning, Barry. Go ahead.
Fine, Barry. It's important.
Even knowing that it was coming, they had no way to change the orbit or anything. So, the fact that it was a surprise is almost irrelevant. Even if they had an advanced warning, they couldn't have done anything about it.
Barry, your modulation is very heavy. You're over-modulating the particular transmitter you're using right now in the FM mode. Probably set up for the sideband mode. The best you could do, if you could predict exactly when and where it's going to hit, is maybe evacuate the people or tell them to duck and cover. But other than that, we have very little forewarning right now of near-Earth objects, and we have, to my knowledge, no defensive hardware at all. N2 Moonbounce, K2RIW.
Oh, hi, Barry. Okay, now, the other thing is that these objects, evidently both of them, were over the Soviet Union. Is there any reason for that, or is that pure coincidental?
Pure coincidental. We have reason to believe that a really major event took place a few million years ago and hit in the western area of the Gulf of Mexico. And another major event hit very near the southern border of Canada and the United States. We can see great big chunks of land that are disturbed in a particular way that's been weathered all these years and almost disappeared from the markings of the Earth. But there's nothing magic about the Soviet Union as far as being hit. Mother Nature's not angry at them, Barry. Go ahead.
WH4YY.
Barry, go to 805, K6CTC clear. At home. Very interesting, guys. I'm going to go back to listening. N2MB, Rocky Ray Beach.
Go to 805.
Go ahead, John. WH4YY, K2RIW.
I know why you keep my Gulf Beach on.
I know. John and Joe, of course. Go ahead, Joe.
There must be a direct formula. I don't know what it is, but, they can calculate the mass, or they can estimate the mass of the thing, which I guess because of the size, they know how much of something this thing is. And I guess through a physics formula, if they know the mass of something and how fast it's going, when it does hit the Earth, it equals so many, so much force. All right? So if you said this thing was a couple of meters, 20 meters long or 20 meters in diameter or whatever the thing was, that's one thing. Imagine something even half the size of Manhattan, and that's not very, very big as far as space rocks are concerned, ever came through the atmosphere and hit someplace on the Earth. I don't know if you could just simply evacuate the population. That would create a tremendous, tremendous area of devastation. Back to you.
Yeah, a really big piece of space junk hitting the Earth will create an awful lot of local damage where it hits. Blast wave, heat, shock, and leveling buildings, leveling trees, and whatever. But the next big thing that these things can do, if it's a really big one, is create a global nuclear winter. In the process of that much material, at such a high velocity, it's got an awful lot of kinetic energy. That kinetic energy is going to be burning itself up in the atmosphere. You heat up the atmosphere that much, you create what they call global a nuclear winter. So our weather is going to be disturbed for years to come. And all of that soot in the atmosphere means that an awful lot of sunlight doesn't hit the Earth anymore. And therefore, a hell of a lot of your plants die. And the average temperature of the Earth goes down, Earth's surface goes down at a very low temperature. It is believed that the mass extinction of roughly 65 million years ago was one of those nuclear winter events of a very large piece of space junk hitting the Earth. Because, let me drop.
That was the Yucatan Peninsula. And how big do they estimate that piece of junk was?
That I don't know, but you and I can look that up. But the piece of space junk apparently contained quite a bit of iridium. Deposited a lot of iridium in the atmosphere. So when you look at the layers of Earth at places like Grand Canyon, you'll see this strip of iridium, if I remember correctly. That tells you how many years ago and how significant was that event. And that it seems to all correlate with the 65 million years ago Earth extinction. Mass extinction, and the Earth has had something like four or five mass extinctions in our history. So, in the earlier days, we were being hit possibly more frequently by big pieces of space junk. It is kind of sad. The good news now is that the Earth has vacuumed out an awful lot of the near-Earth objects that used to come close to us. Let me drop.
I think they said 6 miles off.
You think that one was 6 miles in diameter, Paul? And so we have, in theory, the Earth and Jupiter have vacuumed up an awful lot of the pieces of space junk that used to be capable of hitting the Earth. But still, not all of them are gone. So we're going to be hit again. The thing to discuss is how many years, how big, and yes, once you know the angle in space it came from, and there's various ways you can estimate the velocity, the diameter, and when you see the movies that are done by your dashboard cameras and so on, there's all kinds of ways you can do a good estimate to the nearest 2-to-1 ratio of how big and how fast and how much damage and so on. So it's all calculatable. And if you were head of a space agency, Paul, would you start devoting funds to building hardware capable of giving us protection from these near-Earth objects? WS2N, K2IZW, the second air.
You'd have to have different types of hardware, you know, for different situations. I would go with the Sentinel first, anything like that, especially a telescope looking out along the ecliptic plane, you know, this way you can at least figure out things that are going to come into near-Earth orbit. Ones that come from the Oort cloud, they might come from overhead, you know, from the north pole of the sun or something. There's not much you can do about that. Yeah, I think they said 6 miles because they said, could you imagine this asteroid hitting the Earth? When it's hitting the Earth, the top of the asteroid is still up where the jets fly, you know. I heard a report like that. That lets me think it was around 6 miles high. You know, jets are usually a little high, about 8 miles high sometimes, but, you know, you could imagine if they're coming at 40,000 miles an hour. By the way, you said 42,000 miles on the one in Russia. Yeah, the show I saw was 45, I thought it was 45,000, but, you know, a couple of thousand miles off. And that same show that they highlighted the story about this near-Earth object that hit Russia. It said the people in Russia are fanatical with riding around with cameras in their car. They are paranoid about a lot of things. And
all have cameras in that car, so that was the best place for it to hit for people to get recordings. They have hundreds and hundreds of visual recordings of this thing coming in back to you there.
Yeah, I think the reason the Russians have so many dashboard cameras in their cars is for insurance reasons. I think there's something peculiar about their automobile insurance, and who gets blamed? That if you've got a camera showing what really took place during the accident, you stand a good chance of not being blamed for causing it, and therefore not having your rates go sky high. That's what I think is going on there, Paul. WS2NK2LIW.
I'll have to find out next time I'm on HF. I get a guy from up north in Russia somewhere and find out about that. That's an interesting thing to find out. They didn't state the reason. They said that they all have cameras in their car. Back to you there.
Okay, anybody within the sound of my voice have any further questions or comments with reference to space, broadcast, ham radio, any subject? Now's your time. Give me your call letters and name right now. KQIIW in the text end.
Let another one go. Why not? You like answering questions, especially of technical nature. Ready for this one?
Yes, I am, Joe. The guy who sometimes is called John. Go ahead, Joe.
That's reverse. Reset the beep there. Okay. I know planes have systems on them that work with orbiting satellites. I guess if you're sick of stuff that's, you know, way up. I guess, what is it, 12,000 or 20, what the hell is it? 12,000 or 20,000 miles up, something like that. The stationary system, and they can seem to be able to communicate or at least receive back and forth okay from those, because they're flying wings level and you have nothing above you except just clouds to obstruct it. And I guess they use some sort of, you know, not dish on the plane, but some sort of, you know, roundish type of antenna to be able to receive this thing. What do they do on ships? I heard on ships they have some sort of system that can anticipate the wave coming. I'm not sure how this works. This is what my question is. They can anticipate the wave somehow and keep the dish aimed at the satellite, at the bird they intend to have it aimed at. Have you ever heard anything about that? I thought I heard something years ago that it's a fairly complicated system and how it works. Back to you, Dick.
Well, there are stabilization systems we have on our drone helicopter-like things, which can make the camera beautifully straight and level, even though you're flying it on a windy day. As your ship begins to roll and hit waves, a stabilization system can easily, by gyroscopic action among other ways, it can easily keep the dish aimed at the same point in the sky. So you don't have to know that the wave is coming ahead of time. You can be compensating your gimbal system on that dish as the ship begins to roll with that wave. So stabilizing a dish to aim at a particular satellite is relatively easy here, Joe. WHYY, K2LIW.
Okay, so you've heard of this system already, and you think it's all just run with gyroscopic action to, you know, so there's no anticipation involved. It just simply will keep the thing aimed at the right point. That's very interesting now.
Yeah, there's a set of about 10 YouTube videos you can go to that are done by a guy who lives in Dix Hills. I'm about to get to his call letters. If you look up his call letters, get his name, and you go to YouTube video, and he's going to show you a whole lot of pictures of him flying his drone helicopter over Long Island. He flies it up to 400 feet or 500 feet above the Long Island Expressway, above his Dix Hills home. And beautiful looking pictures. And it's got a built-in camera stabilizing system. And that camera stabilizing system, even on a windy day, you can see the are times when a gust of wind comes along, the helicopter is tilting. For short periods of time, you will see the blades of the helicopter come in view of the camera. And yet the camera, looking at the horizon, has not even 1 degree of motion, if you know what I mean. The camera stays completely level with the horizon, even though the body of the helicopter is bouncing all over the place. So the stabilization systems these days have gotten very good. On my next transmission, I'll give you the call letters of this guy. And as I said, you go to YouTube video, you go to YouTube, and you simply have him search for his name. And my goodness, you see some beautiful pictures of Long Island at high altitude, flying from his backyard up and back down again. Back to you for any comments on this one, Joe, K2IW.
The only thing I would have to say is the man loves his toys.
Any of these guys who fly electrically powered, radio-controlled airplanes, every one of them falls in the category where you can say they love their toys. They get so much fun out of it, it's hard. It becomes a drug, if you know what I mean. Stand by while I get this guy's call letters for you. His call letters are KC2YSK. Kilo Charlie 2, Yankee Serrere, Sierra Kilo. His name is Jay Marcucci. M-A-R-C-U-C-C-I. M-A-R-C-U-C-C-I. You go to YouTube video. You simply do a search on Jay Marcucci. M-A-R-C-U-C-C-I. And you'll see a series of about 10 YouTube videos. Each one of his flights, sometimes with the sound turned on, each one of the flights lasts from 5 minutes to 15 minutes. And you will see a modern-day drone. I'm talking about $500 worth of hardware, and the built-in camera stabilization on that is just out of sight. The ship itself, in gusting wind in the wintertime or in the spring, can be bouncing all over the place, and that camera doesn't move one iota. Back to you for any fill on that one, Joe. W2RYY, K2RIW.
I believe you said KC2KCY. Was that correct?
KC2YSK. KC2 Yankee Sierra Kilowatt. Kilo Charlie 2 Yankee Sierra Kilowatt. J Marcucci. M-A-R-C-U-C-C-I. You simply Google the word M-A-R-C-U-C-C-I or do a search when you're on YouTube and you'll start seeing his videos. And you'll be amazed. You're going to want one of those toys if you watch enough of his videos, Joe.
KC2YSK. Okay, very good. You almost had me fooled there from I was going to say, I thought it would be a guy by the name of K2RAW would have something like that. Maybe next week.
No, haven't gotten into that one yet. I'm into radio-controlled sailplanes, but haven't gotten into the radio-controlled helicopters yet, the drones. And they've come a long way. They're being developed at a very fast pace. A hell of a lot of the news reports you see these days, where they're showing you an aerial view of a particular event, a fire, a shooting, an automobile accident, or whatever. You'd be amazed how many of those news reports these days you think they're coming from a helicopter, a manned helicopter. I'll bet you 90% of them these days are coming from unmanned helicopters. Fire departments are using them, and law enforcement is using them. Over to you, Joe, K2RIW.
Oh, you're right on that. I've seen different news clips, and they're saying different law enforcement agencies, especially, and fire departments, start using it for surveillance operations, search and rescue, and the likes. And they, I guess you've got a skilled operator behind that thing. You make the thing do anything it has to do. That's a great, good invention. They're using it for a positive purpose instead of flying it like a numbskull near airports.
Only a very small percentage of people are doing that. And the most significant thing with radio-controlled drones these days is that starting about a year and a half ago, the Federal Aviation Administration forced everyone to register those vehicles to make sure they knew who you are. If it weighed more than, I think it was half a pound or something like that, a pound and a half, you had to register it with the FAA. About a month ago, a federal law came down that that was unconstitutional. The FAA did not have that authorization to do that. And all of a sudden, all these people that have gone through the process of paying their fee and registering their helicopter, they no longer have to register them. That all got wiped out in the last month. I wonder if you heard about that one, Joe. K2LIW.
Yes, I did. I did hear about that. Now, how does one person, whether it be a judge, I mean, how do they come up with the, you know, I guess the power behind it, where they're going to bang the hammer and they're going to make, you know, they're going to say, well, you can't do that. It's completely, I think it's completely for a safety issue. Because they've had a couple of near misses in some of these major airports, and you know as well as I do, one of these things gets sucked into an airliner's engine on these 200 planes, especially if it's coming in on land and it's maybe, you know, only a couple hundred feet above the ground, that's a disaster in a matter of a half a second.
It certainly would be an unpleasant situation. I'd like to believe that the more intelligent people with those things, because they're a little bit pricey, and therefore, I'd like to believe it's a somewhat educated person that buys and uses the thing and he's not going to be using it near an airport. That's what I want to believe. But right now there is a very large number of people buying and using these things. And so there's going to be a couple of people out there that are going to abuse them. They're going to be violating people's personal rights or privacy and so on. In theory, you can use it to look in people's windows, just to give you an example. I can give you the call letters of a guy who in western Pennsylvania owns five towers of about 100 foot high or 150 foot high. And a couple of his friends have done some aerial photography of his towers. And boy, it's beautiful looking stuff. You know, to see one of these drones fly parallel to the tower, starting at ground level and slowly rise all the way up to the top, while a human being is on the tower doing service. Beautiful looking pictures. High resolution, no, you know, gimbal locked camera that has no jitter to it. And so the camera looks like it's almost being held by another human being on an adjacent tower. And even that person has a very steady hand, but yet it can change altitude and orientation. So I'll get you the call letters of that guy when you go to QRZ.com. And you look at his information page, you can find a whole lot of these movies of his property. And the guy's got about an acre and a half of property, which is just filled up with ham radio towers. K2LIW listening. Anybody got any further comments or questions? Okay, we've almost run out of people to do any questioning or talking, Paul. So unless you've got any further information you want to give us, maybe we'll end a little early tonight. WS2N, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, I just had one other thing. I don't know if you ever heard of the XS1 program. XS1 is it's a development by DARPA, the defense agency. DARPA is created this thing, and they want to launch a rocket vertical takeoff, but it looks like an airplane, and it's got a secondary payload sticking that bone, like sticking out of the fuselage, and it's going to be launched. Going to go into space, be able to have the capability of bringing up, I don't know, thousands of pounds, like 3,000 pounds to orbit. They call it the XS1 program by DARPA, you know, DARPA, and Aerojet Rocketdyne. They've been around forever. They're going to be producing the engine for this thing. But it's got wings. They already just got an approval to launch it from Cape Canaveral. We 2020 is going to be the first one, so like 3 years from now. And it's going to be a reusable plane. It's going to land back at the runway, the same runway that the shuttle used to take land from. And then they want to be able to launch it multiple times per year, like 10 or 12 times per year. So I don't know if you heard of the XS-1 program. No people, of course, just payloads up to around 3,000, maybe 5,000 pounds. Back to this.
Is that aircraft that's being built at Mojave Airport in California, which has got the world's biggest wingspan, it's got dual fuselage, it's going to be used to lift a spacecraft up to a high altitude before it launches? Is that the one you're talking about, Paul? CQLIW?
No, that's the Strata Fortress. No, wait. Correction. What's the name of that thing? Strata something or other. It'll come to me. I got a mental block. That's the one with over a 300-foot wingspan. That's nearing completion. They're going to run some tests on it, and maybe within about a year they'll start flying it. And that has six, the same jet engines that are on 747s. Each one's over 50,000 pounds of thrust. So it's going to carry six of them to bring up probably the Pegasus rocket. Up to 45,000 feet where they'll drop it, and then that, reignite and go into space. That's a different system. The XS-1 program. Let me drop it.
Yeah, what's unique about XS-1, Paul, Dad?
I hit the key by accident. What'd you say?
What is unique about the XS-1 program?
Yeah, they finally gave it a name, by the way. It's been under development for probably 6 or 7 years at least. Phantom Express, they call it. Boeing's involved with it. And it's going to be taking off vertically. Looks like an airplane. It's going to go. This airplane, essentially, is really like a first stage. It's going to bring it up to into space. From the back of the fuselage, they're going to launch another rocket, and in that rocket we'll have this payload, whatever it might be, but probably mostly, of course, the military. And then this plane will come back and land on the runway. They'll be able to refuel it and send it back up again. It's going to be using liquid oxygen. It's an AR-22, AR for Aerojet Rocketdyne, and the gentleman building it is going to be the number 22. It's almost a direct copy of the RS-25. The RS-25s are the ones that the space shuttle used for their main engines. And in those cases, they were over 500,000 pounds for thrust on those. So this thing's going to be one big hefty engine in the back of it. Looks like a space plane with regular wings on it. But it's an interesting development. And, they're going full blast on it. They really want this capability. The reason why is because if an unfriendly country decides to interfere with our satellites for any reason whatsoever, put something up immediately. Either they're going to interfere with their satellite by physically destroying them or affecting their transmission, jamming. We'll be able to put anything up immediately. So that's why it's really on a quick pace to the development. But, I got pictures of it. Back to you.
If there is an agency that is often pronounced DARPA, which stands for Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, D-A-R-P-A. So I think that's what you were calling D-A-R-P-P-A before. I think it's D-A-R-P-A, Eric. I mean, Paul. Advanced Research Project Agency with the word defense in front of it. And they've been around a long time. They do some good work. KQLAW.
Yeah, DARPA. You know, they're the ones that they run the contest out in the Mojave Desert, and they'll have all these automated vehicles, nobody driving in it, crossing the desert. They've got to go like hundreds of miles from one place to the other. Yeah, a lot of DARPA projects have come out over the years. And without that, you wouldn't have a lot of this high-tech development that goes on. But there's been a lot of companies trying to fulfill this need. You know, Northrop Grumman was involved. They probably still are. And they might, you know, they might have something else on the books that they want to do. But this one is by Boeing and Aerojet. Boeing for the vehicle, Aerojet for the rocket. So, but it's just another one of these many different vehicles that are going to be taking off to Cape Canaveral. Cape Canaveral and Kennedy Spaceport have really become a multi-use group, not only just the government, plenty of different governments using, you know, different parts of our government using it. Air Force, NASA, DARPA now, private companies, SpaceX, Orbital ATK now has a launch facility down there. They want to put up their own satellites. Now you've got Blue Origin taking over Launch Complex 36. It's going to be launching there. New Glenn rocket eventually, which is, I mean, if you look at it, it looks like it's almost the size of a Saturn V rocket, a little smaller, but you know, bigger than the SpaceX rocket.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
What is it? Let's see. Vector is another one. They're going to be launching small rockets. So, come back 3, 4, 5 years from now, and there's going to be so much news of stuff going up in Florida and California. It's going to be incredible.
In the United States right now, we've got a total of how many private corporations developing space hardware? Is there about approximately 5 of them, Paul? KQIW?
Well, you have Lockheed, which is really Lockheed Martin, Boeing, and they operate independent of one another, and then they link together, and they, you know, part of their companies are linked together, and they call themselves United Launch Alliance, and they're the ones that launch a lot of the rockets, Delta 2s, they're getting phased out, Delta 4s, all the Atlas 5s, they're going to be launching the Vulcan rockets, which will eventually replace the Atlas 5s, so you got those people, you got SpaceX, you've got Orbital ATK, new companies like I just mentioned, Vector. Then you've got another new company that just launched their first rocket, New Zealand. You're talking about just the United States or worldwide? I mean, worldwide, it's just, you know, there's no end to it.
Yeah, I was interested mostly in the United States. Do we have about 5 or 6 just the United States?
Yeah, I would say so. Private launch companies. I should include Branson with that, Virgin Galactic, because so he's from England. He plans on launching from the United States once he develops Unity. Unity is vehicle that's going to be launching suborbital, so he'll be getting into space with like 6 or 8 people on board.
Has he said recently when his next launch is going to be? Is he accepting a payment for tickets as he goes right now?
I think he's got 600 people. I think it's 600 people that have paid $200,000 ahead, and that started like 10 years ago. He thought he would have had this done by now. He was getting close, and then that one vehicle that he was testing, he got to the point where he was testing the rocket, and getting it higher and higher each time they tested it. And then they had a malfunction. They said the pilot hit a wrong button or a lever or something, and this fold up wing thing that he said he's got in the back folded up as the rocket was on. And that shouldn't have done that, and it made the vehicle crash out in the desert. And then that was, 2012, and he's been recovering ever since. And now he's got a brand new vehicle. He's tested blown that, I think, about 5 or 6 times so far. And when I say test, he drops it from the White Knight. He'll drop it from that, from the White Knight it's a carrier vehicle. And it lands, and they've done a number of different tests at this point. And now his next test is to put a rocket in there. I mean, the rocket, he's got to put fuel on board. He's got to be able to see if this thing launches. And each time he does it, he's got a pilot, co-pilot. It's not an autonomous vehicle. But he's got to be careful he doesn't hurt anybody else in the process. And this year he'll be doing that, and he won't give a date. My guess is you'll probably have to wait till the very end of this year before you have a pilot, co-pilot, have a rocket on this particular plane. It's going to be able to carry up these people and maybe go into space probably by the end of this year. That's my guess, unless he's got problems, and that will be delayed for another year. Back to this. Speech worldwide.
Go ahead, Joe.
Was it the same guy that was going to, it was the same guy advertised about flights going around the moon? I don't know how much that's going to cost. You heard anything about that recently? Something about some sort of automated rocket that you get on, this thing takes your flight around the moon, a couple of us around the moon, and you come back. And my question related to something like that is he going to send out a test vehicle first to make sure he can do this properly without human beings on board? Because if he sends human beings up there, something goes wrong with this thing. These people are not technical. They can't go outside and fix the problem or help do anything about it. Correct?
Yeah, was it Elon Musk that was thinking of sending people either in orbit around the moon or in orbit around Mars? Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, when his announcement came out, he said in 2018, by the end of 2018, he was going to be able to send 2 people on a Dragon crewed vehicle around the moon and back. And now, I believe about a month ago, I read it's been delayed to around 2020. So, I knew that would happen. I mean, he also said that in 2018, he was going to send a crewed vehicle, unmanned, to Mars. It was going to land on Mars with propulsion. He still wants to do that again. That's now 2020. So just like a lot of people in the space business, NASA, especially Elon Musk and NASA, they make these predictions. It sounds good at the time until they get into it, and then they find out that they're a year or two behind, or sometimes longer. Like the Falcon Heavy, that's going to be launched probably maybe in September. Original launch was planned for 2013, so that's 4 years ago, say, 4 years behind on that. But a lot of things come up in between. You know, he shifts his focus from one thing to another. You know, he concentrates on that. But at least it's self-funded. You know, I mean, he doesn't even have to worry about the stock market. But
in the case of Virgin Atlantic, those flights that get you to the threshold of space for a couple of minutes, did you say 600 people have signed up for that, and most of them have already paid? And what's the price of that ticket? Run that by again. Those numbers look awful big to me, Paul. WS2N, K2LAW.
Yeah, I think it was about 10 years ago when he started taking money for it. And 600 people have paid $200,000 for a seat. Ready to go. So... I'm not one of them. The other one that's going to be suborbital is the new Shepard by Jeff Bezos and Blue Origin. That one, you go straight up like a rocket. You'll shoot out from Texas. Straight up from in a rocket, suborbital, and then come back down on a parachute. The rocket will come down, to boost it. Now we'll land vertically. He's done that 5 times successfully. Of course, no people yet. But he sent up a crew vehicle with no crew. And that's come down on a parachute about 5 different times so far. So he's getting there, too. He might beat out Virgin Galactic. Back to you there.
$100,000 for a couple of minutes in space, and 600 people have signed up, and most of them have paid. Wow. I presume that's the majority of his financing, although maybe he doesn't really need all that financing. I think his airliner is doing reasonably well, although from time to time we hear reports that the airline industry as a whole, when you add it all together, they tend not to make a profit. How about you, Paul? K2IW.
Yeah. I know he's got the airline. I guess that's okay. I follow the space end of it. He's also got Virgin Mobile. So how many billions of dollars can he collect from the telephone?
Now, almost anybody involved in cellular telephone seems to be doing very well. There's something like 7.5 billion cellular telephones, portable telephones, in use right now. More people, more cell phones than the population. And more people have a cell phone than have access to a toilet. So it tells you where our emphasis is. I think I'm going to end a little early tonight, Paul, unless somebody else has got another subject they want to discuss. K2LAW for one more listen.
No, that's it. 73.6.
Okay. That was TechNet number 1655. That was Space Report number 255. Bye-bye, you all. We'll be next week back. And we'll settle a few more of these issues. See you guys down the log. K2LAW clear. Be kind to each other.
Night. We'll catch you next week. Joe, have a good one. Anybody else? 73, goodbye. We'll be here lunch tomorrow, probably around 2:30. Get near a computer, bring up Space X website. They'll have it on. Don't bring up NASA, they won't have it. No NASA money is involved in it. Watch it land on a barge 400 miles out. Amazing, about 8 minutes after launch. Really does good. He really gets good pictures now. Have a good one, guys. WS2N clear.
6:30. This is the W2VL Amateur Radio Repeater System. The time is 12:04 a.m. 73, and good night from the W2VL Repeater. W2VL Repeater System. Net tonight at 8:30. Welcome to the W2VL Repeater.
Thank you for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, code number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto-connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
Thank you.
Good morning. The time is 5 a.m. Net tonight at 8:30. This is the WQVL Amateur Radio Repeater System. WQVL repeater.
Oscar in Massapequa Park on that one.
move Mike to the lead tango. Jeffrey, I think we've covered him before. You move? Okay, Jeffrey. Who's the other station that is to be moved? Sorry, I didn't copy the last transmission. Oh, you said something about if Jeffrey moved, repeat it, turn it over to him. Okay, my name is Jeffrey, Kilo 2, Mike Gilman Tango, handing it over to the other station. Oh, you are coming back, Jeffrey. What are you doing up so early? It's not actually early. I got up about an hour ago. I'm retired. Do I get on the radio, okay? Yeah, I'm a school teacher, so I gotta get to school before the kids do. They get there at 7:30, so I'm on my way. I'm almost there. I'm driving towards the Dunhill Road in the Bronx. I thought you lived in Flushing or a different part. Did you move recently? About 5 years ago, I used to be in Whitestone, Queens. I have a 30-year girlfriend that liked it here. So I sold the house and we came out to Massapequa Park. Where do you teach? My mother was a teacher, God rest her soul. She taught the school called Jane Addams. Jane Addams Vocational High. She was a math teacher. Many years. Good for her. Yes, I teach at PS 76, off Gunhill Road, the Bronx. I teach special education in fourth grade.
Very good, Jeffrey. I have a special thing in my heart for teachers. Most people don't really respect what they do. I remember my mother at night would have to do lesson plans, sometimes rowdy kids, she had to call her home. She was also in charge of the GEO, so she got 2 periods. I don't normally get to 5 periods. She did 3, because she spent 2 periods in the GEO. And she was also the, what do they call it again? The union member for the UFC and that school.
Can be. Richie, I'm just shivering for you. Go. Okay.
Hi, Jeffrey.
Very good, teacher.
And then somebody came in and shut that. Say again, Jeffrey.
United Federation of Teachers, UFC, you are correct.
Women, a little noise. Please say again, Jeffrey.
Sorry. United Federation of Teachers, UFC, you have the acronym correct.
Well, I know it's the UFC, that I know. But she was a shop. What